Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I want you to listen to me. I mean it, no joke. This Newport's a smoke with a smooth taste. I know you'll agree.
A report from a Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee says that removing menthol-flavored cigarettes from the market would benefit public health. But the report stops short of making a recommendation on a controversial issue, whether the cigarettes should be banned. Menthol cigarettes have been around since the 1920s and make up about 30% of industry sales. But critics argue the minty flavoring masks the harsh taste of cigarettes, and that makes them enticing to young smokers. The debate is also racially charged. That's because 80% of African-American smokers choose menthol brands like Newport and Kool. Some African-American organizations, such as the National Black Chamber of Commerce, say banning menthol cigarettes would unfairly take away brands preferred by many blacks. Brands like Newport have been heavily marketed to African-Americans for years. According to a study by Philip Gardner, a researcher at the University of California, tobacco industry surveys in the 1960s found that many blacks thought menthols were safer than regular cigarettes. TV ads in the 50s and 60s may help explain why. They often depicted menthol cigarettes as cool and refreshing.
The finest leaf tobacco, mild, refreshing menthol, and the world's most thoroughly tested filter. As cool and as clean as a breath of fresh air.
The ads weren't directed at blacks in particular, but the messages were echoed in magazine and billboard ads intended for a black audience. Gardner's research shows that the percentage of black smokers who chose menthol jumped from 5% to 44% between 1953 and 1976, and kept climbing after that. Some former U.S. health secretaries and other tobacco control advocates say the flavoring should be banned because it makes cigarettes more attractive to young blacks. African Americans have disproportionately high rates of smoking-related disease. Lorillard and other tobacco companies say menthol cigarette smokers face no greater risk of disease than non-menthol smokers, a point that has been corroborated by independent scientific research. Tobacco companies also say they don't market to youth. Lorillard gets almost 90% of its roughly $5 billion in annual sales from the Newport menthol brand. The company has mounted a public relations campaign to prevent any ban of the cigarettes. The FDA panel is scheduled to submit its report to the agency next week, but it's not clear what the agency will decide. Officials there say any action could take years to be implemented.
It's so refreshing while you're smoking Newport.
For the Wall Street Journal Digital Network, I'm Kelsey Hubbard.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, September 21st, 2016. So I have been told. Quickly, we will be here tomorrow, 24 hours from now, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Workplace racism. If you have commentary, observations, if you have discovered some strategies that would be useful for other victims of racism, black people on the job, to help them solve problems, minimize conflict, definitely dial in. We'll be looking forward to hearing, discussing with folks tomorrow, Thursday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. That's it. The broadcast for today, extremely important and not something that we have failed to discuss. If you were tuned in early, you heard the audio clip playing Vernelia Randall. She's a professor at the University of Dayton in Ohio. She's been on the program repeatedly, but on her very first trip to the cows over 7 years ago, we discussed her book, Dying While Black. She has a whole section in that book where she talks about the tobacco industry, racism, and the impact of cigarette smoking on the health of black people. And she, too, didn't just talk about this from a scholarly point. If you heard in the audio segment, she prefaced everything by saying that, you know, to put some flesh and blood on this, that she lost her father due to cigarette related illness, that he tried everything to quit smoking, and he just could not kick the habit and ultimately died from cigarette smoking. But she just shared a lot of great information, some of which you heard in that audio segment. And really, just to emphasize the importance of today's broadcast all the way through, more people die. 45,000 black people per year die from cigarette-related illnesses. That is more than homicides, AIDS, and car accidents. I think a lot of people, I know I can say, I hear a lot of folks talking about AIDS ravaging the black community, and this is terrible, we need to do something about this. I hear a lot of talk about homicides and black-on-black crime, and we shouldn't be focused on the police, black people kill each other, blah, 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 blah. Cigarette-related illnesses kill more people, more black people per year than all of those. It is the number one preventable cause of death that is targeting black people, which is astounding on many levels. I think people should keep that in mind. At least I would submit that should be kept in mind when we think about, talk about all of the controversy around legalizing cannabis, that this would be something we should think about. But moving forward, our topic for today, really trying to get more of the information about this issue. There was a report in the New York Times just within the last 2 weeks or so, black health experts renew fight against menthol, menthol cigarettes specifically, which have been deliberately targeted to black people. We'll share some of that information as we go. I was reading the report. I was reminded of what Vernelia Randall shared with us and thought that it would be really important to just get more of the information out. I'm sure, unfortunately, that some of our black listeners, either we have some smokers in our audience, or we definitely have people who know people, people that we care about, family members, friends who are smokers, and just hopefully getting more information out about this subject. That is definitely one thing that we can do to work against racism, white supremacy, and promote black health. Make every effort to stop smoking if you already are, to make sure that if you have children or other people that you care about, that you really hammer this home. This is one thing that we can do to work against racism, to really make sure that black people are in opposition to smoking, doing all that we can to make sure that we're not increasing the numbers of black people that are smoking, and particularly younger black people, to make sure that they do not pick up this habit. With that, our guest for today's program, she was referenced in the New York Times piece and just has really phenomenal research on this subject matter. I would really encourage, I'm going to try to name as many of her different reports as I can as we roll through the program, would encourage listeners to go to her faculty webpage and read some of these reports, share the information. It's just really outstanding research that I think would tremendously benefit black people. She's an associate professor of health policy in the Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences and in the Center of Tobacco Control Research Education. She examines tobacco usage as a social justice issue that disproportionately injures black people. As I said, she's devoted years of work, even going through a lot of the internal documents from the tobacco industry to see what they said about their efforts to market to black people. Joining us live, our guest just back from the Congressional Black Caucus meetings in Washington, D.C., where they met with President Obama dealing with some of these topics, our guest, Dr. Valerie Yerger. Dr. Yerger, are you with us?
Hi, how are you? I wish we had a chance to speak with President Obama. That didn't happen. We weren't really expecting it to, but we thought that we had to do everything we possibly could to get his ears. But it's not too late. He's still in office, so maybe we'll get a call from the White House.
We will cross our fingers. Thank you so much, Dr. Yerger, for sharing some of your Wednesday afternoon. Really great to be able to discuss some of your phenomenal research. Just anything that you think would be important for listeners to know about who you are, the work that you do?
Sure. I was impressed, and I got online when Dr. Vermilia was talking about menthol, and I know that she's done a lot of work around trying to expose some of the social justice issues around the tobacco industry. But I am trained and licensed as a naturopathic doctor. I started my career wanting to practice medicine, but doing it from a natural medicine, holistic perspective, and was also, in fact, the first non-nurse midwife licensed in the state of California. So I was really focused on wellness and helping people to maintain their health. And I had an opportunity back in the late 90s to work with a researcher by the name of Dr. Ruth Malone. And Dr. Ruth Malone had a working relationship with Dr. Stan Glantz, and the two of them were looking for the first time at these tobacco industry documents that were released as a made public as a result of the 1998 Master Settlement Agreement. And no one was looking at these documents in terms of the African-American community. So there was a little niche there for me to sort of like slip in and start looking at what the industry was saying about targeting my community, what they were saying in their confidential documents, what they were saying in private meetings. And I have to tell you that when I first started looking at these documents, I felt compelled to try to get the information out. I basically gave up my clinical practice to study these documents and to expose the industry. And I was probably one of the first to do a comprehensive review of these documents. And granted, we only got a slither of what's in there, because we're talking about millions and millions of pages of documents. And I was just stunned. I was stunned to find that looking at their relationship with African-American community groups, at our leadership groups, the industry had a pervasive presence. They were everywhere. Now, I grew up with my grandparents being members of the NAACP. I'm a member of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated. I have lots of family and close friends who are prominent members of many of our organizations. And to see that they had a relationship with the industry just totally blew my mind. It broke my heart because what is, I believe, unknown to these groups, it's what the industry was saying behind closed doors. So in many ways, the industry was sending out their representatives, many of whom had very high positions within tobacco companies, who looked very much like us, who had relationships, who basically were members of our community, but they were paid very well to basically form relationships with the leaders of these organizations. And through these relationships, the tobacco industry funneled money, but other types of support. So it wasn't always a money thing. It was providing, for example, meeting space, providing free packs of cigarettes, all kinds of types of sponsorships, just as a way of being able to influence what these Black leaders would do within their positions of power. So it was mind-blowing that nothing was done just for the sake of supporting these organizations. It was really to have influence, not only at the federal level, but also at the state and local level. And it was also a way of keeping the industry forefront and visible in the community, so that, you know, we got used to seeing their logos. We got used to seeing their colors. We just got used to it that we didn't even question their presence. And all along, smoking the products, all along, watching our family members die. And I watched my mother die from her tobacco-related disease. I watched my grandmother die. And it's nothing that happens overnight. It is a long, drawn-out event that takes a huge, huge toll on our community and our families.
Ashe, as I said, very personal issue for a lot of Black people who have lost loved ones due to cigarette-related illnesses. Just for our listeners, they might not have seen you. This might be their first time hearing from you. You're a Black female. Is that correct, Dr. Yoger?
I am a Black female with Black children and Black grandchildren.
Right on. This program, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that what we're talking about with these health disparities targeting Black people and what the tobacco industry has done, that is a symptom of the global system of racism, white supremacy. I use the term racism and the term white supremacy as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Yeah, I do think that is a very valid definition. And if we take a look at, and we're staying within the context of tobacco, we see that at work. I was just very interested in hearing, part of the previous program before I came on, that you quoted a tobacco industry executive who said that menthol cigarettes are not more harmful than regular cigarettes. And so I was actually approached by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration because of my expertise in searching the tobacco industry documents. And they came to me in preparation for the work that the newly acquired office, the Center for Tobacco Products, as a result of the 2009 Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act. They wanted me to pull together a team, which I did. We went into the tobacco industry documents, and we wanted to know what it was the tobacco industry knew about menthol. And we looked at various topics, health being one of them. We looked at dependency. We looked at smoking behavior. We looked at smoking initiation. And we looked at smoking cessation. And we found very compelling evidence showing that the tobacco industry was very much aware that menthol had a very intimate relationship with all these topics. However, health was not the one that we were able to show. Granted, everyone knows that all smoking is harmful. But when you have a product that increases the likelihood that someone's going to start smoking, when you have a product that decreases the likelihood that someone is not going to be able to quit, when you have a product that has been shown to be specifically targeted to a number of different marginalized communities, including African Americans, you have a problem. And the health issue takes a back seat because it's the reasons why people are made to smoke that keeps them smoking, that makes them susceptible to all the harms of smoking. So I'm very, very careful not to go down that road about health. I want to stay focused on the fact that you have a group of individuals, African Americans, who were basically targeted by an industry that had no goodwill intent at all. Their only intent was to market their products, to get people to purchase those products, and to make sure that they had a constant flow of new smokers to replace those that had died or could no longer continue to be consumers. So that's where the issue is. And And we were able to show through our research that the tobacco industry had set up very, very specific programs that were very, very specifically designed. And they were very specific, not just in terms of looking at all African Americans, but they focused entirely, almost entirely, on those individuals who are African American living in low income communities, where they could go in and the industry could go and talk to the retailers and incentivize the retailers and get the retailers to participate in making sure that these products were not only accessible to the community, but were quite visible. And they were very, very intent on making the advertising very, very, if you will, friendly, consumer friendly, so that you see yourself, and you not only see yourself in these ads, but you see yourself being somebody you wish you were. So very, very intentional, and very manipulative and very effective. And I actually had come across a document, 1989 document by Reynolds, that when talking about one of their very specific marketing programs that was very directed towards African Americans, they talk about our young black male and how our young black male is so very powerful because he is a trendsetter. And if we can just focus our attention on getting him to like and to use our products, guess what? The rest of society will follow. Now, this was part of their plan. And sure enough, we have watched it progress. And we heard earlier about Dr. Phil Gardner, my colleague, who talked about the progressive use of menthol within the African-American community, and how, you know, back in the 50s, I believe we were like 5% of the smokers, of African-American smokers, used menthol. And then in the 60s, it grew a little bit more. But then towards the 70s and 80s, there was this intense marketing scheme where a tobacco company started to see that as a result of the 1964 Surgeon General report, that they were going to start seeing a reduction in the use of their products. And sure enough, that is exactly what we've been seeing in terms of the non-menthol brands. Smoking's going down, but for menthol smoking, it is continuing to go up. So menthol cigarettes is very, very important for the viability of the tobacco industry. And these companies knew that. And back in the 70s, there was one brand that was very popular, and you might know this, it was Cool Cigarettes. And so Lorillard, which is the company at the time that was making Newport, saw this trend, and they figured if we're going to be a viable tobacco company, we're going to have to get a piece of the menthol market. And if we're going to get a piece of the menthol market, we're going to have to compete for the smokers who are smoking Cool Cigarettes. And we have documents after documents to talk about their intention to be competitive within the low-income African-American community as a way of competing with their with the other brands, such as Cool. And nobody even knew what Lorillard was doing. Nobody knew this Newport brand, and it just slowly started to take a hold of our community, where right now, today, and 2016, the majority of African Americans who are smoking, they smoke menthol, they're smoking Newports, because the individuals who used to smoke Cool are aging and may no longer even be on this planet. And I was actually with a group of students in Richmond, California about 3 months ago, and these are high school students. They didn't even know what Cool was. It wasn't until one of the students went on the, you know, she went on her little smartphone and she pulled it up. She said, oh, okay, that, I know Cool. I guess I do. But they knew Newport. And the people who are now smoking Newport are, what, 50s, 60s? And so Lorillard was very, very successful in gaining the control of the menthol. And they got out a few years ago, right? Because Reynolds saw that their products were being very successful, and they wanted to make sure that they had a viable piece of that, of the cigarette market, which, i.e., menthol, which that's why they bought Newport cigarettes. So now Reynolds has control of Newport.
Wow. Context of white supremacy. I do know Kuhl's, when I just reading your many different reports that you worked on and co-authored, I worked at a black comedy club in Atlanta, which was a city that popped up repeatedly in your research, and they used to get promotional material from Kuhl's. And I mean, when I say they had boxes of menthol cigarettes packed everywhere, it was like you had to fight to find room to store the Kuhl's cigarettes, because they got sun. They would just come in by box loads and box loads and box loads. And tons of black people that worked at the club or just came there, they smoked menthol cigarettes, even though most of the people that smoked there, they smoked Newports. But there were readily cool menthol cigarettes available by the box load while I was there. One thing that I did want to make sure that I asked you to touch on, because I think this is really significant to kind of put all this in context when we think about the research that you put forward and how black people have been deliberately targeted by the tobacco industry, especially for these menthol cigarettes. You have different works, different papers that look at the relationship between melanin and nicotine. Two of the reports you co-authored, one of them is linked between facultative melanin and tobacco use among African Americans. This was in 2009. And then melanin and nicotine, a review of the literature. This is from 2005. Just to read a quick paragraph before I get your commentary, in the 2009 report that you co-authored, the paragraph reads, as posited by Yerger and Malone, 2006, the role of melanin in tissue uptake of nicotine and tobacco-specific carcinogens has potential implications for individuals with high levels of melanin. Given that nicotine has affinity for melanin, high levels of melanin might allow for a greater amount of nicotine to accumulate in melanin-containing tissues. Considering that melanin-containing tissues may represent a reservoir or storage for nicotine, it is plausible that higher melanin concentrations may contribute to higher degree of nicotine dependence and lower quit rates. I think this is real important for black people to kind of think about all of this when we think about black people being targeted for cigarette smoking. Can you talk about your research with melanin and nicotine?
Yeah, I absolutely can. And it's I will say to you that I have had the privilege of talking to a wide range of African-Americans about smoking, and I'm talking young, old, rich, poor, living in the suburb, living in the inner city, leaders, mothers. When I talk about melanin, I get everybody's attention. So I know it's a hook, and it's a very, very important hook. So when I was trying to understand, as we heard earlier, because African-Americans smoke fewer cigarettes per day, because they become regular cigarette smokers later in life, I wanted to understand why it was we were seeing more tobacco-related diseases and cancers within African-Americans. And as I was going into the literature, there seemed to be a lot of focus on how the liver metabolizes nicotine. And there was just a suggestion that because African Americans are different genetically, that's why they're having all these issues with smoking. I didn't buy that. I didn't buy it because there's so much genetic variability within African Americans that you can't say that we all show up with a particular genotype. So I started to think in terms of what else is it that African Americans have in common. And of course, you know, I thought about stress, because I know that stress is a huge variable in our lives. And I also thought about melanin. And I had not seen or heard anything at that time about the relationship between melanin and nicotine. So what I did was I went into the tobacco industry documents and I started searching. And I kind of figured if anybody was doing any research, it would be the tobacco industry, because basically that's what they do and they've got a lot of money to do it. And sure enough, I came across a few documents that showed as far back as the 1950s, the tobacco industry was funding research to look at how nicotine is distributed within animal tissues. And one of the things that was discovered kind of accidentally is that those tissues that contain melanin, which include skin, eyes — melanin is contained throughout our body, including our brains — that those tissues containing melanin accumulated nicotine. And that led me on a massive search of the literature. And so the first paper that you mentioned was my literature review. And there actually had been quite a bit of research looking at how nicotine accumulates in tissues containing melanin, but none of them were really making that stretch, that implication that, you know, people who have darker skin have higher levels of melanin. So is there any connection between higher rates of tobacco disease, tobacco-related disease, and people who have darker skin? So after the paper was published, a colleague of mine — I actually didn't know this gentleman, I knew of him — Gary King, who was a professor at Penn State, contacted me and said, "This is fascinating. Let's do look at this more closely." So he actually got funding to do a project in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where we basically had a sample of about 150 African Americans, and we were able to measure the level of melanin in their skin. It's a very easy way to do that that's non-invasive. And we took melanin samples from the forehead and also from under the arm. And the reason why we did those two locations is that the forehead measures facultative melanin. Facultative melanin is a combination of the melanin that we get genetically, but also from sun. And then we took it from underneath the arm as a measurement of the constitutive melanin, which is the genetically determined level. And we all know that under our arms, we're lighter than we are than those areas that are exposed to sun. So we took those measurements. We also measured using a tool called a Fagerstrom survey to find out how dependent someone is to nicotine. And those are questions like, you know, how quickly after you wake up in the morning do you have a smoke? So there are certain ways that you can, you know, just very easily determine how dependent someone is on nicotine. We also looked at nicotine exposure, which is measured by the level of cotinine in one's saliva. Cotinine is the metabolite of nicotine. So once someone smokes nicotine, it will be metabolized very quickly by the liver. And you measure that through this cotinine. And we also did other things, like we looked at stress level, and we also determined how many cigarettes per day someone was smoking. What we found was absolutely incredible. Now, given, you know, we had 150, we were able to get statistic power with our sample, and we were able to show that there was a significant relationship between facultative melanin and the number of cigarettes someone smokes, how dependent they are, and what their cotinine levels are. We did not see that sort of relationship with constitutive. And so that is just absolutely incredible in terms of a finding and suggestive of us needing to do some additional work. So my colleagues and I have been unsuccessful in getting a further study funded. There are people, the reviewers seem to have some sort of pattern to how they reviewed our application. So to make a long story short, we have not done any follow-up because we've not been able to get any significant funding to follow through on this. But one of the things that I think is absolutely critical, and this isn't Dr. Yerger making this up, this comes out of your basic physiology textbook, is that when stress levels are high, and for African Americans, many of us maintain a high level of stress. We're chronically stressed out. And when your body is stressed, your body will produce stress hormones, and they're precursors for these stress hormones. One of these stress hormones, which I will just very, I'll just tell you, it's called ACTH. It stands for adrenal corticotropic hormone. It's part of a larger molecule that's floating around freely in the body. So when the body needs ACTH, it will cleave this complex to release the ACTH. However, one of the other substances that gets released as a result of this cleavage is called MSH, which stands for melanocyte-stimulating hormone. So here's the connection with stress, melanin, and smoking. Nicotine, and this is based on the research that has been widely published, nicotine molecularly looks very similar to one of the precursors for melanin. So when you have melanocyte-stimulating hormone, what is it doing? It's stimulating the synthesis of melanin. So if you've got nicotine floating around, the body will grab a hold of the nicotine because it's confused, and it will bind to it in an effort to synthesize melanin. That's how nicotine is accumulated in melanin-containing tissues. So we know that that goes on. We know that there's evidence that this interaction between nicotine and melanin is not only nicotine, as you mentioned, Gus, it's also tobacco-related carcinogens. Those also get accumulated in tissues containing melanin. But what happens is that there's some damage going on with the tissues, and we don't know to what extent. We don't know how long this accumulation lasts. If it's for months, if it's for years, but there's something going on with this relationship between smoking, exposure to the nicotine, exposure to the tobacco-specific carcinogens, and to the synthesis of melanin, hence skin color. So there's definitely something going on, and it's related to, we think, the stress, because as you know, when you are getting darker as a result of being exposed to the sun, you're stimulating the synthesis of melanin. So when that process is going on and you have exposure to these substances, nicotine and the other carcinogens, you are definitely having some sort of biochemical reaction going on. And in terms of what the results are of this, we don't know. But we just figure it's definitely worthy of being studied and looked at. It's something that just, any way you look at it, it makes sense that there's something there, and there's some need to study it further.
I agree 1,000%. I find it not just a coincidence that you all are, and particularly since you said it seems to be the same pattern when your submissions or proposals for further study of this are rejected. That to me stands out as very suspicious, particularly since, as you stated, it seems there's been research on this anyway, where they accidentally found this relationship between the retention of some of the compounds related to nicotine from cigarette smoking on the tissue with a presence of melanin. I wanted to read just one more paragraph and then ask one quick question on this before getting to some of your other topics that you've covered, and encourage listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Yerger, dial in. Don't be bashful. This is also a passage from that same report, a link between facultative melanin and tobacco use among African Americans. The paragraph reads, "A corollary to this theory is that darker pigmented individuals may be predisposed to greater exposure to nicotine and to tobacco-specific toxins and susceptibility to tobacco-related carcinogens, especially if these toxins are being slowly released from the reservoir of melanin-containing tissues. Thus, the melanin and nicotine hypothesis may have particular import for African-American smokers who tend to have higher levels of melanin and are disproportionately impacted by the tobacco-related health consequences of dependence, morbidity, and mortality." Just if I can synthesize as a layperson, the hypothesis being if melanin, tissue containing melanin, if that does in some way kind of absorb some of these toxins from inhaling smoking cigarettes, that could have really adverse health consequences for Black people, particularly if they're smoking over a long period of time, where you're just piling up more of these toxins in your melanin-heavy tissues, and then it's being released slowly over a period of time in the body, and who knows how long it might take to extricate all that from your system, if I'm reading correctly from the paragraph. The question that I wanted to ask, based on your research in all this, are you familiar with the late psychiatrist Dr. Frances Cress Welsing?
I am.
Oh, okay. She posits that the reason for the system of racism, white supremacy, individuals who classify themselves as white, being melanin deficient, that is why that they target and are so hostile and abusing, terrorizing Black people. I think Dr. Welsing might look at your research and look at what's happening with the cigarettes and Black people being disproportionately targeted for these menthol cigarettes, and particularly since it seems that they have some of this research about the relationship between melanin and nicotine. Does this, in your view, would it be accurate to describe what you've seen with the tobacco industry and Black people? Would it be accurate to classify that as chemical and biological warfare?
I would, and I'd like to also take it a little bit further and not just looking in terms of the melanin piece, because that's definitely, I think, a huge part of what's going on in terms of our continuing to smoke and having a difficult time quitting. But when we think about smoking initiation, it used to be that we used to clearly say that African Americans start smoking later in life. Actually, we start smoking regularly later in life, but we start just as young as some of the other groups. And when we are looking at children who are 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, who are starting to smoke, they have receptor sites in their brains. They have a developing brain. And unfortunately, for these kids who get addicted to nicotine very early, there are brain changes that don't necessarily happen to those kids who don't smoke. And as a result, I use the term, and I'm not the only one to use the term, of nicotine hijacking of our receptor sites. And I'm talking also as a naturopathic doctor, that we have receptor sites that are specific for hormones that we automatically secrete, we intrinsically secrete. We have specific feel-good hormones that help us to feel good, that help us to interact with one another in a loving way, because as the organisms that we are, our goal as an organism is to keep a species alive and perpetuating it. And if I am liking you and you're liking me, we're much more likely to get together and have a healthy relationship that will result in us keeping the species going. Unfortunately, when we have a substance like nicotine that's hijacking these receptor sites, there's no place for our feel-good hormones to go. And, you know, and I can only talk so much about that because I'm not a biochemist or a physiologist, but there's something to be said that the body, which is very, very basic in many ways and tries to maintain homeostasis, that if there's no need for a particular hormone, it's not going to secrete it. So we have a need to, you know, our receptor sites are being hijacked by nicotine, and we're no longer secreting enough of our own intrinsic hormones, then the body's going to do what the body's going to do, and that's going to increase our use of nicotine. And so it's an unfortunate thing for our kids, because we are raising, we're raising generations of kids who don't know what it feels good, what feels good naturally. And but we have a need for that. And so if it's not nicotine, it'll become something else that we, you know, we have all kinds of addictions, you know, other than nicotine addiction, as you know, gambling, sex, shopping, violence, all of these are addictive behaviors that result in our receptor sites being activated. So for me as a naturopathic doctor who has a concern for the wellness of our community, we have to find a way to protect our kids' brains so that their receptor sites do not become available to an industry that doesn't give a crap about our kids. And we also have to ask the question about why it is our leaders who are interfering with us being able to get some meaningful regulation to prevent our kids from having access to menthol cigarettes. What's motivating them? And I'm sickened and I'm disheartened and I'm frustrated because what I'm sharing with you is something that all of us should have information about so that we can make decisions that are based on what's best for our community. And I'm sorry that there are people walking around who feel a need to take big bucks from the tobacco company so they can go around the country and talk about how the work that I'm doing and the work that my colleagues and I are doing around trying to keep these products out of the hands of our kids will cause more of our black kids, our black males in particular, to either end up in jail or a coffin. So I think that those of you who are listening, I speak the truth as I know the truth. A lot of the work that I'm doing, I do on my own dollar. I do it as a volunteer. But if we can sort of embrace this and know that we have an obligation as a village to protect our young ones, and if we have access to our leaders, to talk to our leaders, and to ask some of those hard questions, you know, why is it that President Obama didn't call us into the office? You know, I don't know why. I have my suspicions, but when the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act was signed into law, the purpose of that was to protect children, and obviously not to protect black children. We need to really ask why our kids are still being used as pawns and as a way of keeping a select group of people extremely wealthy, and as a way of keeping an industry that is controlled. I mean, we know that they are federally adjudicated racketeers. you know? But yet their products are allowed to stay on the market. Something's wrong with that. And I think when we start having more and more of people who look like us yelling and screaming, they might do something, because I can tell you that one of the things that I've heard is that there hasn't been action in the White House because they're concerned that black folks are going to riot and have a fit because we've taken away their big product. Now, if you look at the research that's been done with African-American smokers, almost 60 to 70% of them say they support policies that would remove menthol off the market. Majority of people who smoke don't want to smoke. And the minute you show them these documents, the minute you start showing them how they were specifically targeted and that we have a huge social justice issue around this topic, and that they're not bad people because they smoke, that it has been by corporate design that they smoke, they don't want to smoke. So it's part of what we have to do is get the information, share the information, get to our leaders, tell them that we really need to do something. There's no way we can have wellness in our community as long as these products are available. There is no way. They do not go together. So for those of us who are really concerned about keeping our particular community going, because the world is going to continue, the question is, how are we going to continue in the future? And what kinds of brains are we going to have? And what kind of children are we going to have? And we have to start looking in the future and stop thinking about the here and the now, because it's not good enough anymore.
Ah, shit.
I'm sorry.
No apologies. That is exactly the type of information that we wanted to get across to black listeners. Just emphasize that is one thing you can do to fight against racism, white supremacy. If you know black people that smoke, do everything you can to share this sort of information to try to help them to stop that habit or to keep them from even getting involved with it from the beginning, and make sure that emphasize, as Dr. Yerga just said, this is a social justice issue. This, just like police brutality, is another issue of racism, white supremacy, and one thing we could all do, not smoke cigarettes and promote that black people don't smoke cigarettes. Just to the point that you said about the targeting chemical and biological warfare against black children, this was in that same New York Times report, Black Health Experts Renew Fight Against Menthol, that was published earlier this month. Lisa Henriksen, a researcher at the Stanford Prevention Research Center, said she had documented patterns of racial disparities in tobacco marketing. In a 2012 study of tobacco sales near California high schools, she found the higher the enrollment of African-American students, the higher the percentage of advertisements for menthol cigarettes. Newports were cheaper, she found, near schools with higher shares of African American students. Anytime I see things like this, in my view, it's never the benefit of the doubt. It's never coincidence. This is deliberate chemical and biological warfare against black children. Does that make sense to you, Dr. Yerga, how we should view something like that?
Oh, absolutely. And Dr. Henriksen's work was in California, but there's other research that show that this pattern exists in other states as well. So it's widespread. And again, unless you are someone who travels a lot and you go from community to another community, you might not know that what you're seeing on a daily basis, if you are in a heavily targeted community, you might not know that that's not normal in other communities. And it's sort of like, if you think about someone who lives with chronic pain, you get to a point where your body starts to deal with that pain, and part of you, in order for you to survive and function, gets used to a certain level. And it's not until you have relief from that pain that you absolutely realize how much pain you've been in. And it's the same sort of thing, unless we know that there's another way of living in terms of these tobacco industry at in terms of the pricing of the cigarettes, we might think that that's normal, and it isn't normal. So that's why Dr. Hendrickson's work is so important, because she's able to show the evidence that there are some severe differences and disparities. And if that's not enough to make you want to get off your rump and try to do something, it's just a further indication that we really need to get these products out of hand. Because if you can't function, if you can't do anything extra, if you're tired, if you're fatigued, if you're dealing with a whole lot of other acute issues, which many of us are, that's an indication that we need some sort of relief, social, economic, health relief, so that we can start to free ourselves up and have the energy and to have the capacity to start making changes within our own communities. And so it should be a wake-up call that if this isn't moving you, you got to look at, is there something just for the moment that you can do to help yourself out, whether it's watching what you eat, whether it's exercising a little bit more, something. Connecting with people, talking with people, doing a little something so that together we can start moving to take care of our community and our kids. Because if we look at public policy, especially what's coming out of the federal government, there's not much help there for us.
Absolutely. This is, I want to read this and then see if we can get a few callers in as well. I see we have some hands up. This is just an outstanding report, and you have so much great information in terms of the long, toxic relationship between the tobacco industry and black journalists, black leaders, put that in quotes, in terms of, as you stated, not just in terms of financial influence, but lots of things, whether it was paying for office space or providing office space, lots of ways of influencing black people to promote their product and their concepts and ideas about how we should think about smoking or potential bans on smoking and what have you. This is from a report you co-authored, African-American Leadership Groups, Smoking with the Enemy, 2002. You also have another great report, Quid Pro Quo, Tobacco Companies and the Black Press. This is from 2012. Just a phenomenal portion. I want to read this for listeners just to keep this in mind. The brilliance of Dr. Yerger on display here. In this section, it reads, American community, the African-American community, and that this effort was expanded not merely out of generosity, but for at least three specific business reasons: to develop and increase tobacco use among African Americans, to use African Americans as a front line to force, to advance, and defend industry policy positions, and to diffuse or obstruct tobacco control efforts arising from both within and outside the community. The African American community, like other marginalized communities, recognized as strategically important to the industry, has in some instances sought out and benefited from tobacco industry financial support estimated at $25 million yearly. Some might argue that the relationships have been mutually instrumental, since African American groups received needed support in exchange for their backing of pro-tobacco legislation or their silence on health issues. However, given the now widely acknowledged disproportionately destructive impact of tobacco use on African Americans, the price extracted from the community in pain, suffering, sickness, early death, and loss of community elders may outweigh financial gains. At $25 million a year, the 45,000 African Americans who die annually from preventable tobacco-related diseases are figuratively traded for a mere $555 apiece. The tobacco industry regards African Americans as a group with particular historic, social, and economic vulnerabilities, and it exploits these vulnerabilities by attempting to portray addiction to cigarettes as a civil right and a free choice. Brilliance of Dr. Yerger. Just if you want to add anything to that. And I also think it's really significant that you touch on this repeatedly, that when people like yourself or others raise these issues and say, hey, let's get these menthol cigarettes out of black areas or get rid of them completely, it's, hey, that is racist. You're being paternalistic, as though black people can't make a choice for themselves about whether they want to use cigarettes or not, that they will turn around and say you're being racist if you take that sort of position.
Well, given that virtually no one starts smoking after the age of 26, and that the majority of people who get addicted to smoking and start smoking throughout their life get addicted in their teens. We have to come in. We have to come in. And it's not a matter of choice. My colleague, Carol Magruder, does this really wonderful sketch about how she as a mother would not allow her child to do certain things. I mean, that's what parenting is. And so if someone wants to say that I'm paternal, that's how they see it. That's not where I'm coming from at all. I work a lot with smokers, and it's very important that they understand that I'm not pointing my fingers at them. I don't blame them for smoking. I blame the industry. I keep the focus on the industry. And if we could do something right now to prevent the use or the uptake of smoking by our youth, that will decrease the number of adult smokers we have. And we might have to wait a while for that to show up in our community, but we have to start from somewhere. It's just heartbreaking that I can have very influential, important people in our community look at the work that I'm doing and say that it's not important or that I'm being racist or paternalistic. And most of the people who say that, if you get their name, if you get the organization that they are affiliated with, I'd be willing to bet I can go into the tobacco documents and pull up proof that they have a relationship with the industry. So it's industry rhetoric. The industry has been using our African-American organizations, a number of them. They've had long-term relationships with them. Been using them as a front group because the tobacco industry knows that if they stay out of the picture and they're not seen or noticed by the public, that what comes out of the mouths of the people that they put money into their pockets, that they somehow have more credibility with the folks. And we're seeing that now with organizations such as Noble, which is the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement. There's the DPA, which is the Drug Policy Alliance. There's another organization called LEAP, and I have to be honest and say I can't even remember what that stands for. And then you have people like Dr. Ben Chavis, who currently is the president of the Black Press, the National Newspapers Publishers Association, who just last year took $250,000 from Reynolds. And he sits on a panel with these other organizations as they go around the country getting in front of blacks at conferences that are highly attended by black professionals and others who are in influential positions. And they are talking about what would happen, in their words, if menthol is banned and how it will increase the instances between the smoker and the police, and how we know what happens when there's increased interaction. Of course, sometimes bad things happen. But they are really fighting hard and making it more difficult for people who are in the federal government to take a look at getting rid of these menthol cigarettes because they don't want an uproar in the African-American community. And when you have people such as these very influential groups and leaders, I mean, I admire Dr. Chavis. I knew him when he was part of the NAACP. So when you have folks who have these relationships with the community, you know, they're very influential, but the information they're giving is really tainted by their relationship with the industry. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out and to see those connections. So nothing that we can say about what is evident within the industry documents would have any influence on them whatsoever, because their mission is to push industry policies. And that's what they're doing. And unfortunately, they're doing it very well. I mean, let's work together. I don't have an answer for this, but I think that we really need to have some sort of intervention that comes from our within our community that is saying that, look, we have a problem here. We've got to fix this problem. Here's the evidence suggesting that one of the things that we need to do is at least keep these products out of the hands of our kids. And there's a whole continuum of policy options, but we need to have a discussion about what to do. And these other organizations might not even need to be invited. I mean, we have a lot of wealth within our community. I mean, in terms of our capacity and ability to have influence and to put pressure where pressure needs to go. And we've got the truth behind us.
Just before we nab some of our callers to that point about how the tobacco industry, they've spread lots and lots, millions of dollars to either black individuals or organizations so that they will support their pro-tobacco positions or at minimum say nothing. You have a portion, this is from Racialized Geography, Corporate Activity and Health Disparities, Tobacco Industry Targeting of Inner Cities. R.J. Reynolds, marketers emphasize that Salem should be seen as a friend. The best way to reach minority consumers, they argued, was through their local communities, which tend to support brands that they see as doing something for them. But these sorts must be seen as authentic and as being backed by other blacks, not as a big white company's tactic to sell to blacks, which I think is very important. I've heard that sort of sentiment expressed before, I believe, with Planned Parenthood from the early 20th century. They had the same idea, let's get black preachers to go out and promote this idea so they won't think that it's coming from whites and just trying to decrease the numbers of black children being born. But in my view, showing a very sophisticated understanding of racism and how to manipulate black people to purchase their products. If folks have a question they want to ask Dr. Yerger, the number is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Our black female caller in New York, did you have a question for Dr. Yerger? You should be with us.
Yes. Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Dr. Yerger.
Greetings.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you for being on the show. Thank you for giving us all of this information. I appreciated your speaking on the timeline of when black people were targeted by companies and menthol cigarettes, because I am in my early 50s. And I remember as a child going to the store to get my relatives cigarettes that did not have menthol in them. Some of them didn't even have filters in them, particularly Pall Mall and Winston. But I remember that as a kid. And it also, unfortunately, validated my parents okaying my smoking that I started when I was 18. And I smoked for a long time. And I didn't quit until 19 years ago when I had my son, because I decided that I needed to live, right? So I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions. In New York, we have a law against selling something called loosies, which are loose Newport cigarettes. But the law is not enforced, and it only occurs in low-income neighborhoods in New York. But, I mean, you know, the Newports are sold and advertised everywhere, but you can only buy the loosies where there are people who are of low income, mostly in Black and Hispanic neighborhoods. So I wanted to know if you did any research on that, and also, did you do any research on how the companies do a play on words with menthol cigarettes, like advertising them and calling them lights, ultra lights, slim lights, ultra slim lights, blue and such? And that's all I had. Thank you for taking my question. I'll mute my line.
Okay, thank you. The leases are a real problem, and not just in New York. Anywhere you have inner city communities, more than likely individuals, some of whom are underage, can walk into a store and get a single cigarette. If I, as a professional, walk in and ask for a single cigarette, more than likely, especially if it's the first time that the store operator has seen me, will say, what are you talking about? I can't sell you a single cigarette, because they know that it's illegal. But they have relationships with the residents, and it just makes it very, very easy for someone who has very little money to go in and to buy a cigarette. It also discourages cessation, because it makes it more tempting for someone who's trying to quit, and they get that urge. They're much more likely to go get a single cigarette than they are to buy a whole pack of cigarettes. The other thing that you touch upon, you don't really call it unintended consequences of policy or disproportionately enforced policies, but we see that, and we see that a lot with policies in particular, any of it, just in general. There's one thing to get a policy implemented. It's another thing to get it enforced. And unfortunately, for some communities, they don't get the same sort of protection from a policy. And we've seen that over and over again. Again, it's like how important it is for us to be aware of what our rights are and our right to be protected by policies that other communities are enjoying. And those policies are reflecting in changes in behavior, changes in exposure, and we don't see that in all of our communities. That needs to change. And then, what was your second question? Just if you say a word or two, it'll remind me of what it was.
Oh, it's about the play on words that companies use in menthol cigarette advertising.
So, I have not done any particular studying on the messaging, but others have, and I can tell you that the tobacco industry takes marketing very, very seriously, and they use companies that have a relationship with our community, for example, and these are companies that may provide consultation to the tobacco industry if they do to other types of industries, clothing, whatever. And the industry knows enough to know that they don't know everything about a particular community, so they are heavily reliant on people who come out of the community to help them with their marketing. And if you look at the descriptors that you're talking about, low and light, tobacco companies are no longer able to use those descriptors as a result of recent legislation that occurred back in the a few years ago, where I mentioned earlier in this program that the tobacco companies are adjudicated racketeers. That was one of the things that they were actually prevented from doing, is being able to use those descriptors, because they knew that they were deceitful. So people who thought that they were smoking safer cigarettes because they were lighter were in fact getting as much, if not more, of the harmful substances of from the tobacco product, because they were inhaling and smoking differently to compensate for the decreased amount that they were getting in any particular puff. So that's very deceitful. And there are tobacco industry documents that prove that the industry was aware of it and that they knew that they were deceiving the public. So they are no longer able to use those descriptors. And unfortunately, they're finding other ways to convey to smokers whether or not they're getting a product that, for example, this blue that might be menthol, the colors are starting to replace the actual written descriptor.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank
you for
answering that question. And I did not know what that blue was, because like I said, I stopped smoking 19 years ago. So when I saw Newport Blue, I got a bit confused. But thank you for answering my question and clarifying. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's sort of like the tobacco companies are preparing for regulation over their use of the word menthol. So they're starting to educate the smokers now and get familiar with particular colors.
Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Dr. Yerger? You should be with us. Thomas in New York.
Good evening.
Hello.
Greetings.
Good evening. Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Good evening, ma'am. I've had three questions. Let me get to my questions here. Are you familiar with the fake cigarettes?
With what cigarettes?
Fake Newport cigarettes.
Are you saying fake, F-A-T-E?
Yeah, F-A-K-E.
Oh, fake, F-A-K-E. Is that a brand? Are they being marketed as Newport?
Newport cigarettes that are not stamped, therefore they are not real, but they look just like a Newport cigarette. And they're generally sold where I live at in Harlem. They'll get a Virginia stamp on them, an older Virginia stamp that, you know, they get someone to put on them. And they try to say they're from Virginia, but they're not real. When you taste them, it's a big difference. And they make you feel sick. And I know people who only smoke those cigarettes because they sell the pack. You know, a Newport cigarettes in New York are $12 a pack or more. So they sell those for $8 or $7 at the store under the counter. And that's generally the Lucy's people buy, too. They don't sell their real Lucy's. They sell the fake ones. I just want to know if you were familiar with those and what was in them.
I am not familiar with them. I made myself a note of it. But I appreciate you sharing that with me. It seems like it would be worthy of investigating a little more, especially since they may not have, even the real cigarettes have all kinds of crap in them and have thousands of substances that are potentially very harmful in them. But, you know, when you have products that are being illicitly traded and manufactured, there's no way of knowing what's in them. Because they're not regulated. I do know that this is one of the arguments that has come up in terms of regulating menthol cigarettes, that somehow we would be increasing the likelihood of illicit trade. And that is something that is also an industry rhetorical argument. And if you even look at the tobacco, if you look at the U.S. government documents that were created to defend their argument when Indonesia went to the World Trade Organization and said, you're giving special treatment to menthol cigarettes. We're no longer able to market our clove cigarettes because the flavor ban went into effect in 2009 as a result of the 2009 Tobacco Control Act. And so the government, the U.S. government, had to respond to that allegation by Indonesia. And in those documents, it talks a lot about the illicit trade that would occur should menthol be banned. And if you go and you look at the citations that are in those documents, it takes you nowhere. They go around in circle, circle, circle. So they, even the U.S. government does not cite, you know, a valid research article or work that has been done to show that this illicit trade would be a real, real issue. So, but it's one that you're going to hear a lot. It's just not necessarily founded on evidence.
Wow. My next question was, I believe it was on this show, and Gus could correct me if I'm wrong, there was a guest, a doctor, who was talking about sugar. And he was saying that United States is the only country to put sugar in their cigarettes, and that's what makes them so addictive. And usually when people stop smoking cigarettes, they usually crave candy and things like that to crave, you know, to I guess, feed that craving. Are you familiar with that?
I am not familiar, but I do know that the industry uses all kinds of chemicals as a way of making these products addictive. And what's interesting, too, is that menthol is added to virtually all tobacco products, not just to those cigarettes that are marketed as menthol. And the reason being is that menthol has a very intimate relationship with nicotine, and the tobacco industry knows that, which is why they include menthol in all these in all the cigarette brands. And there is research that the tobacco companies have done to show that when menthol is added, you don't need quite as much nicotine. So as their concerns with nicotine levels being regulated by the government, they were looking at ways of making sure that their products were still as satisfying to the consumers. So they know that by adding menthol that they can maintain the level of satisfaction in a cigarette product, even if the nicotine levels are reduced. So nicotine and menthol have this very tightly tight relationship. And also menthol stimulates one of the nerves that basically runs through our head. And the reason why this particular nerve is so important is that it increases, when this nerve is stimulated, it increases the a smoker liking a product. And so nicotine stimulates that nerve, as does menthol. So whereas the tobacco companies will come out and tell you that menthol is part of their taste recipe, it's much more than that. Menthol is very, very important to the industry for these other reasons that I share it with you. So I am not surprised that there's research showing that there are other additives in cigarettes that increase the likelihood that somebody's going to continue using that product.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah, the guy said, I believe, I know he said this, I believe it was this show, he said the United States uses sugar to dry out the tobacco faster, and therefore it sweetens the tobacco, which is why U.S. cigarettes are a hot commodity worldwide. That was his analysis. My last question is, ways to stop smoking cigarettes, do you have any? I have been offered pills, but they seem to be SSRIs, and I'm not, you know, willing to take them to stop. Are there any other methods? I've heard of hypnosis and other things. Can you tell me your educated, you know, way to stop smoking if it's a hard time, hard way for you to do it, just going cold turkey?
Yeah, so, you know, I actually was part of a research study that looked at the perceptions that African-American smokers had for some of these products, including the nicotine patch and the gum. And so there's just a lot of fear and hesitancy in using these products. And one of the things that we found is that people aren't educated about how to use the products. So I would urge you, if you haven't already you know, if you don't have a relationship or you haven't explored your relationship with your health care provider and seeing if this particular person is available to help you use these products correctly, I would do that. Because if you don't use the products correctly, you can have a negative experience. And unfortunately, we don't necessarily have to have that experience. We could have a family member or someone who's close to us who's had a negative experience. And so for that reason, we don't want to do that. But as a naturopathic doctor, you know, one of the things that I am interested in are what are some of the other natural things that are out there to help people to quit smoking and to deal with their addiction. And I do have colleagues in the field who have had very high success rates in helping people to quit. And I think there's mixed evidence out there in terms of acupuncture. And you'd be surprised, there are a lot of people, especially men, it's more difficult for women, but men seem to have an easier time quitting cold turkey. And if you kind of take into effect, and I know I talked earlier about the accumulation of nicotine and melanin, and we don't know how protective melanin may be or whether melanin is just a reservoir and the nicotine is gradually released from these tissues, that's something that we need to have some additional research on. But typically, nicotine doesn't stay in your body very long. And so if you are able to keep yourself distracted and to work with your cravings for, they say that roughly 96 hours, that your craving that you have would not be because of the nicotine, because the nicotine would no longer be acting on you. It would be related to some of the other behavioral behaviors that you have around smoking, your triggers. And I watch my mother and I watch others very close to me who have been dealing with their nicotine addiction. And I've had every last one of them say that those cravings that you get tend to lessen in time and they don't tend to last that long. So that if you get triggered by a craving and you start to do something that you enjoy doing, whatever that might be, that you'll come to know the craving kind of disappeared. So those are things that that you can think of, and then getting some additional help. I don't know where exactly you are, but I think most states have quit lines. And I know in California, there was a study that showed that the quit line actually is being utilized very well by the majority of African-American smokers who want to quit, and that they are getting help from calling. I also have worked with low-income, homeless African-American male smokers, and one of the things that was very helpful for them was just learning how to just be still and to meditate and to breathe, and that did wonders for them. So, you know, a lot of times the triggers are what you need to identify and get rid of or try to eliminate them as much as possible, or at least to have some awareness around what the triggers are so that you don't find yourself automatically responding to those triggers by lighting up.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Great questions. I think that was Mwebe Ashangi. He was on the program a few times. I think he was the one that was referencing sugar being one of the additives in U.S. cigarettes. I think this is Roz. Roz, did you have a question for Dr. Yerger? You should be with us.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings to you, Gus, and greetings and good evening to you, Dr. Yerger.
Hello.
Yes, thank you. I greatly appreciate you being on this program. Just listening to a lot of what you discussed made me think about just my own life, because my mother smoked up until the time she found out she was pregnant with me, and she stopped. But I was born with a heart murmur and asthma due to her smoking prior to knowing that she was pregnant with me. And then at the age of 11, I tried smoking for the first time. And when my mother found out, she never discussed it with me. She just threw the cigarettes away. She didn't smoke herself. She would keep them around for guests. And I started sneaking them at 11. And then I smoked quite a few of them, and then she got rid of them and never said anything to me about it. Then as a young adult, I started smoking again, but I would only smoke when I was stressed out. So it wasn't something where I was addicted in the sense where I had to smoke every day or smoke a certain number of packs a day. It was more or less if I had a stressful time at work, I would smoke at work. When I came home, I didn't smoke at all. And if I smoked at home, I smoked outside the house, never inside the house because my son was there when he was really little. I stopped smoking when he was very young. So thankfully I don't smoke now. I haven't smoked in a very long time. It's been probably since I was 25. I'm now 43. And, the questions that I have for you, actually you answered a couple of them in regards to menthol. And I was actually going to ask about that, but you answered that question. And then, Thomas in New York asked you about sugar because I was going to ask you about that as well. But I remember reading, many years ago that, the industry added at least 19 additional addictive ingredients in cigarettes. And I know you said that they do flood cigarettes with all kinds of chemicals. Were you aware of those specific ingredients that were addictive that were added in addition to the nicotine that's naturally in tobacco? Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
I there's a long, long list. You can actually go into any website that has layman's information about the additives in cigarettes and see the long list. I would venture to say that nothing is in there accidentally, that there's a purpose for everything that's in the products, and that these products are designed to keep people smoking them. There's nothing good about smoking. So I don't know if that's answering your question, but I do know that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of ingredients that they add, and every one of them is to work synergistically with others to make these products addictive. So the industry has spent lots of money to hire some of the brightest chemists and others who are very important for the manufacturing of these products.
Thank you. You did answer my question.
Very intentional.
I'm sorry.
I was just saying it's very intentional what they put in there.
Thank you, and I totally agree. And I did have one more question that I thought about earlier this year. I read an article that Britain had done an experiment in which they had a control group that smoked processed cigarettes, and they had another control group that smoked cigarettes the way indigenous Americans smoked it, and in other words, in its natural state. And they said they had found that tobacco smoked in its natural state did not cause cancer or the diseases that are associated with processed cigarettes. And I wanted to know if you knew anything about that, or is there a difference between the two from your research and your experience? Thank you.
Yeah, I don't have, my research doesn't really look at the differences between the commercial use and the traditional use. But I have many colleagues who are working with tribal nations here in the United States. And as you know, traditional use of tobacco is very important to many of them, not to all, but to many of them. And part of the issues that they currently are having is they don't have access to traditional tobacco. So they've been relying on commercial tobacco, which comes with all this junk and harmful and deadly stuff in it, as part of their ritual so that they can continue practicing as they have for generations and generations. So there's definitely a difference between the two. The tobacco plant, as part of, you know, somebody who appreciates botanical medicine, has a function. And anytime you take any product, any plant product, and you commercialize it, and you start to add all kinds of processing additives to it, you're going to change the whole intent of why that plant is here in the first place.
Appreciate that, Roz. Thank you for the questions. The caller at 1902, did you have a question for Dr. Yerger? You should be with us. Caller, last four digits, 1902. Are you with us or you just listening? Seems like you had your hand up. I don't know if you hit your mute button or if you got something going on with your audio, but we are not hearing you if you had a question.
I'm sorry, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hi, Dr. Yerger. Good evening. This was to the any caller out there. I'm 37 years old. I quit smoking. I smoked, I think, since I was 15. I'd quit maybe 4 years ago, officially cold turkey. That's what they call it. And honestly, it was what helped me, exactly what you said. I would be still. I wouldn't move. I would kind of just look into nothing and kind of just focus on, as a fight, individual rounds. I would use it like that and not move. And, it, you know, after 3 days, it got rough towards, you know, after like 10 days, it got worse, you know, where the urge would call you, you know. And I started to look around as I quit and watch how people smoked in the rain, in the snow. And you kind of realize you look extremely goofy smoking, you know, just trying to find cover. And, you know, it looked bad. And, you know, and when it comes down to, like, just in your social life of dating or anything, it became a terrible habitual thing, you know. Your clothes smell like it, you smell like it. And it just was unsavory. So this is to all the callers out there. You know, I wouldn't move. I wouldn't buy anymore. I just didn't move. And that's what helped me. So thanks for letting me comment. Thanks.
Thank you for that.
I
love the fact that you guys are sharing with each other, because that's where a lot of our help will come from. You know, we're people who rely on, social connections and sharing of knowledge and wisdom and experiences. And we can fall back on that even in terms of dealing with something as difficult as a nicotine addiction.
I'm sorry, Gus. I have one more question. I apologize. I really have one question. It's the vapor that people are moving to. I know that's not what your research is focused on, but I see a lot of young black youth, you know, that when I'm at work, they try to quit, which is good, but they move on to the vapor because they see the white people using vapor. And to me, it doesn't make sense. It's like, if you're going to quit. I don't know what that vapor is about, but from what I got, it creates horrible breath, halitosis. It's horrible. So I got some friends that really, really invest in it, and they feel better, but they still kind of smoke here and there. They dabble, you know, so it doesn't make any sense to me. I was wondering if you had any suggestions about that, or had any, you know, anybody talk to you about the whole vapor craze that's going on.
It's a huge problem. You know, I think it's something that caught a number of us off guard. Like, all of a sudden there's an electronic cigarette and then everybody's smoking it. And now the electronic cigarette has evolved into these vaping devices. And some of them, these big tanks, they release like massive amounts of vapor. And I have never experienced it, and I don't like to walk through these fumes as they are being put out there into the air. But I've watched people sort of like do it, and then they're looking at it like that's the bigger and the better it is. And I think that's just absolutely a sad thing, because there's research, some of which has been done by a young African-American female here in California, that Monique Williams, she's like one of the first ones to look at what's inside these vapors, and there are things like fiberglass and other things that are very destructive, and they can trigger asthma in someone who already has asthma, especially if it's a young child. So the vapor is not safe. There are a couple of other things that I want to say about these products is that a lot of people start smoking them because they're under the impression that this is a good way to start to quit. And what research has shown over and over and over again is that people don't quit smoking with these things. It does not lead to cessation. And meaning that people continue to feed into their addiction. So it's not a cessation tool. So that is really a sad thing because people are misinformed. And the other thing is that we have worked, some of us have worked really hard at getting these tobacco-free, smoke-free policies, and all of a sudden, we're starting to see smoking more, so it's really working against all the denormalizing that we've done around smoking, because now it's like, if you get used to seeing it, your kids aren't going to be saying, what is that? They're going to be knowing it again. So all of the decades amount of work that we've done around creating smoke-free environments are now starting to wither away because people are feeling very comfortable using these devices in public. Now, if you've ever, I don't know if you've recently been on an airplane, but even on airplanes, they specifically say you cannot smoke electronic cigarettes. And they say that because they know that these products are harmful from those who are exposed to it. So it's not an alternative to smoking at all. And I would heavily advise people to just stay away from them. And it's just an unfortunate thing because our kids are using them probably more than any other group. You know, their use is increasing exponentially, unfortunately.
Absolutely. I've seen a lot of those as well. Our caller in New York, lady. Did you have a question for Dr. Yeager? Lady in New York, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, doctor. Thank you for coming on the show. I worked as a cessation counselor for about 2 years or more, and one of the things that I was finding with smokers in general, especially African-American smokers, was the issue with having something to do with their hands and mouth. Even how people tap on their cigarettes or on the carton to get a cigarette out was something that they had become very accustomed to. It was a habit. It was something that they did numerous times throughout the day. And people have a lot of time of shaking those habits. Even like just the motion of their thumb striking the lighter. Do you have any suggestions for callers or for listeners on dealing with that? Because that was a really big theme throughout my time of working as a counselor of people saying, I need to do something with my mouth. I'm putting an imaginary cigarette to my mouth and I haven't smoked for 3 months.
Yeah, that the behavioral piece is what is very difficult and it takes a lot of time to deal with. As I mentioned earlier, that you know nicotine will clear from your body, and after 96 hours, you no longer have the nicotine in your body. You're no longer responding to the addictive part of the nicotine. It's just these other behavioral things that are the issue. As I've mentioned before, and I'm not a cessation expert, and I've not even held cessation classes. I would venture to say that you probably are more an expert at this than I am. But I do know how important it is to identify what those triggers are and to just start catching yourself, and to find other ways of distracting yourself. But I don't, you know, I don't think there is a magic pill for dealing with this. And I think that whereas one person who has an oral fixation can easily deal with that need to have something in their mouth by having, I've heard people using cinnamon sticks or something that they can just put in their mouth and suck on, or trying to find something else to do with their hands or fingers or whatever it is that they do, probably differ from person to person. So I think that part of what goes on with smoking is unconscious, and that part of dealing with letting go of your smoking is becoming conscious, and you just got to put work into it. There's no other easy way of doing it. Even the gentleman who spoke earlier, who said that he quit smoking cold turkey, I'm sure he still had challenges, but he was able to maintain his level of not smoking. And it may take people a while. It's very unlikely that people quit on their first try. And there's something to be said about multiple times of quitting, because we know that sometimes you have to try a number of times before you're successful in staying quit for a year or 2 years or longer. And that's just part of the process. And not to, I don't want to give people permission to pick up a cigarette after they've not had a cigarette for a while, thinking, oh, this is just my first try. But seriously, to just be very conscious of what they're doing and just to give themselves permission to work at this.
Great. That sounds like everything I would advise someone who's trying to quit or who's had some type of, I guess, relapse from having a time period of not smoking and going back to smoking. When you spoke of children, I had a question. The transparency of young children, including infant and baby skins, and having parents that smoke. I looked into some things, and they presented us into some things when I was working as a counselor to specifically tell women who were pregnant or who had young children that the baby skin is transparent, and if you go back to smoking, you come home, you have it in your hair and on your hands, when you touch your young child, that their skin can absorb that toxin. Have you read anything about that, researched anything about that, as that being true, or have you ever came across any material referring to that?
I think I understand what you're saying, and I would say that the younger the child is, the more susceptible they are to secondhand smoke, and we know now third-hand smoke, right? So third-hand smoke is the residual of the cigarette components that are left as a result of the actual smoking. So you can have third-hand smoke on your hair, on your clothes, on the carpet, on the walls, and there's also research showing that depending on what substance the tobacco residual residue is on, that it's still very active and can still interact with the environment, which is a really big reason why we shouldn't be smoking inside or definitely around our children. So, you know, it makes sense that young kids and babies in particular are extremely vulnerable, because they're actively, I mean, their cells are actively still dividing and changing and shifting, because that's what babies do. You know, they're growing. And so anytime we have any sort of cellular process going on externally, there's just many opportunities for things to interact. So, I haven't really looked at that. That's not really my area of research, but I think it's safe to say that we can be intuitive here, and we can make sense out of what's being presented to us based on our prior education and experience. And if there's nothing that is available as a research article that you can pick up and look at, if something is seeming to make sense to you in the moment, that we should be able to rely on how we're interpreting something, you know. So it makes sense that that would be an issue. And we know that our baby's lungs are much more susceptible. And we know from research that was recently released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that our children in particular are much more likely to be exposed to secondhand and thirdhand smoke than white kids are, just because African Americans are much more likely to smoke in the home when they do smoke. So there are lots of good reasons for us to not smoke and to use whatever we can in order to not pick it up and to quit if we're smoking, to find some way to get some help, and to realize that you are not a bad person because you're smoking. We are smoking at a higher level now and have a higher issues with smoking because we were disproportionately targeted by the tobacco industry. That was intentional.
Thank you for taking my questions.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Well, sure. I think this is our last caller, the person dialed in, 3637. Did you have a question for Dr. Valerie Yerger?
Yes, I did. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, doctor, and thank you for coming to talk to us today.
Oh,
and I just
welcome.
All right. I wanted to know, have you came across any research of people who smoke marijuana, but they rolled their marijuana in cigar paper, which is, I mean, that's tobacco. I think that's tobacco leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe
mm-hmm.
it being, oh, it is, okay. And then maybe it being extra difficult for someone to stop smoking marijuana because then they have to fight the marijuana addiction and the tobacco addiction?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a habit that a number of our young black folks have. So it's a huge problem, and they call them blunts. And now when you go into stores, you can find the blunt papers. I was told, and I didn't do the research myself, but I was told that the tobacco companies became quite aware that young people were taking these cigars, and they would stand outside the convenience store or the liquor store, and they would push the tobacco out so that they could have the leaf available. And the retailers were getting really upset with all these tobacco products being left on the sidewalk. And so somebody in the industry got wind of this and just made the wrappers because there was a demand for it. But you're absolutely right that this is a concern that many of us have in terms of trying to work with our young people and keep them from not picking up the habit of smoking, is that they do use these tobacco leaves for as a vehicle for getting their marijuana. So I'm sure others on the call probably have a lot more information than I do, because it's not something that I personally engaged in as a practice, and I haven't looked specifically at the use of this among our young kids. I just know that it's an issue, it's a problem, and as the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act put a prohibited the use of flavors in cigarettes other than, you know, menthol was exempt from that. They did not deal with the flavored little cigars or cigarillos, that those were still available as flavors. And you know, quite frankly, the flavors are very, very attractive to young folks. And it's our youth who are smoking these flavored cigars. And so it is. It's a huge problem. I don't know if I can say anything more about it, but it is definitely a way for the nicotine to get inside our kids' brains and keep them using the products.
Thank you. Thank you for answering my question.
Okay, you're welcome.
For sure. Before we allow you to enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening, I definitely wanted to ask, because we've had a lot of conversation. I'm in Washington State myself, and they legalized recreational cannabis back in 2012. So we've got the stores and all that, and now they even have billboards up advertising cannabis the same way you would see, you know, McDonald's or a gas station or what have you. Cannabis is up there now. And big debate, something that's been talked about a lot. I think it's on the ballot coming up in November to be voted on in California, recreational legalization of cannabis. What are your thoughts? Is this going to be something that is constructive if this becomes legalized and promoted? And particularly a lot of the commentary now saying that there are no health deficits for consumption of cannabis. This is not something that's like cigarettes that's going to be very harmful. People are recreationally using marijuana. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I obviously this is a very controversial subject for many of us who are doing tobacco control, because it's still an act of smoking, and we're working to try to have a smoke-free, tobacco-free environment. On the other hand, we do have a social justice issue around the use of marijuana and who's actually going and being incarcerated because of these products. And so it was kind of like weighing the social justice aspect of these products versus the actual use of these products and any particular harm that they might have. And I'm on the fence, and I'm sorry that I'm not much more definitive, and I guess as a voter, I'm going to have to make a decision as to how I'm going to vote on this. But I've heard arguments for both sides that are pretty compelling to me, and I just, you know, some folks are going to be very firm about how they are on this particular issue, and I've come across those people, but I have to be honest with you, I'm not one of them. I have family members, people that I know who have been smoking their whole lives, albeit illegally, and they're not productive. So I don't want to suggest that smoking makes you unproductive, because there are people who do some good work while they're under the influence, but I don't know what our society is going to look like. I'm actually concerned about it, you know, to be honest with you, because I don't know. It's a hard one. It's a hard one. And, you know, and I would be judging folks, you know, because I've been around for almost six decades. I've seen a lot. And I don't know what's going to happen. And I know that we're still waiting to hear from these other states that have legalized. And I think there's some indication that there's, you know, increased accidents on the road, at least coming out of Colorado. I would have expected, and I haven't seen a lot of interaction between our state and other states that have already legalized cannabis, to talk about their lessons learned. I think we would benefit from it, but I'm wishy-washy on this. I'm not the right person to ask. I apologize for that. One of the two things I haven't really firmly decided on yet.
Hmm. I appreciate the candor. No apology needed. I can't say from Washington State that I've seen at least two different reports. The first was 2013, and then more recently this year in the Washington Post, where they've said that for this state, it's still too early to be able to make an assessment, because I think a lot of the what I view as rhetoric around we need to legalize cannabis, this is a social justice issue because the disproportionate number of non-white people who get locked up around cannabis-related crimes, that it's still too early to see if legalization has had an impact on decreasing the number of black people that end up being arrested or involved somehow in the criminal justice system. It's too early to have data on that. They have come out definitively and said, no doubt about it, it does make cannabis cheaper once you legalize. They have definitive evidence on that for Washington State, but they could not say whether that's a benefit or a negative. I guess one thing that I would point out, I know for Colorado, they have data where young people, young black people specifically, they said that even after it was legalized, that they're still having a disproportionate number of younger black people that are being arrested for offenses related to cannabis. So it has not stopped those arrests, which I am not surprised about. I guess the other I have for years on this program, I was here in Seattle when they legalized. I have for years stated that I am not supportive of this because I just don't believe that this is going to benefit black people if we're still in a system of racism. White supremacy is what you said. I've seen a lot of black people that consume cannabis, and it has not been helpful for them, and particularly being in Washington State, seeing the proliferation of products that are now happening as a result of it being legalized, and you have, you know, cannabis gummy bears and cannabis Skittles and lollipops and all this other stuff, which seems very much like it would be marketing to children, in addition to the billboards and what have you. I just don't see how that would make things better for black people if that were to become a national thing in a system of racism. But also the chemical component, particularly I saw this from the very beginning, Big Tobacco was getting involved with the cannabis industry, thinking that, hey, all of this lobbying against cigarettes, we should just switch our product to the wacky tobacco and then everything will be good. We can just go and start mass producing that. And I said, I could see a lot of the same things happening where if they start mass producing cannabis, and then you have to start wondering, well, what chemicals are they putting in it and what toxins and that sort of thing, where you just end up with a lot of the same problems where this is just not going to make things better for black people. Does any of that sound reasonable, Dr. Yerger?
Yeah, to me it does, and it's something that I've had a question about. I've even suggested to people to start taking a look at who's buying up the land. Look at who's buying up the land in California, at least. I don't have time to do that. It's not part of my research program, but I'm suspicious of who's going to be behind the market for these products here in the state, and how it is that we might be able to prevent any sort of large industry, be it the tobacco industry. I've heard that there's been some foreign interest groups that have taken up a lot of the land, and they're growing these products here in the state in preparation. We're going to end up in a situation where, again, we are consumers and we're not even a part of the economic, we don't benefit economically from this growing industry. And I've already met individuals from our community who are very much interested in trying to be a competitor, and they are not being allowed in. So when we have populations that are suffering socially, economically, health-wise, and we're chronically stressed, and there's no relief for that stress, there's no relief for being able to increase our, not only increasing the money in our pockets, but also increasing our sense of financial literacy, so that there's a desire for us to put money in our pocket and to keep that money in our pocket. And when we spend it, to spend it within our community and to make sure that we're not turning our money over every 11 minutes, as I've heard, and that unlike communities, other communities where the money will turn around within their businesses 22 to 30 times before it leaves, we don't do that. And until we start
putting out an effort to do that as a way of having a better way of living for ourselves and just wanting the wellness that we so much deserve, we're going to be self-medicating because there's just kind of like a need to do that. I mean, we can only take so much in terms of the pressures and the stress, and no individual should be expected to just deal with one crap after another, after another, after another without having some sort of relief. So smoking, whether smoking tobacco or smoking cannabis or doing a number of other behaviors that are designed for keeping our brain receptors busy, we're self-medicating. And we have to look at how it is that we can start to work within ourselves as a community and really address the demand side of what's happening around us, and learn to live amongst ourselves and not get consumed by what's happening around us, because, you know, I've got my eyes open. Everybody has their eyes open, and it's not a pretty sight always. But we can carve a way for ourselves if we learn to trust in one another again and learn to rely upon each other and to recognize that we have gifts that we can, you know, share and even stimulate an economy. So that's, I don't think cannabis is the answer for that.
We shall see. At least the research that I saw, I think the most recent polls, they said it looked like about 55% of the folks were saying, yes, let's approve. And that's lined up with about what I thought was going to happen. I was very confident California was going to go ahead and legalize this time. So I guess that'll be something to pay attention to this coming November. We had one late straggler. Did you have time for a final caller before you exit?
Sure.
All righty. The caller at 0997. Did you have a question for Dr. Yerger?
I just wanted to ask the doctor, and good evening. My name is Cradell Bragg. I just wanted to ask the doctor, was she aware that marijuana was the national crop of this country, also tobacco, which they got from the copper color people of this country, and for years that it was a textile. They made all kinds of things out of hemp. It was a great, it was the number one industry in this country. George Washington used hemp, many things. Ford made a car out of hemp, completely organic. My argument is this: the pharmaceutical companies, the alcohol industry, and the tobacco industry are the main lobbies against marijuana. My ideal is that that's direct competition. If you take the marijuana off the black market economy, which is a multi-billion dollar economy around the world, and legalize it like it should be, like everything else, like alcohol should be legal, marijuana is less harmful than alcohol. And you can see the devastation alcohol has done. You see the devastation cigarettes have done around the world to the moment. And that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate your comments. Thank you for that.
Oh, I guess his question, did you know about the staple crop, cannabis hemp being a staple crop in this area of the world? That was his question before his comments.
United States, major of the United States, until they came up with the Federal Stamp Act, which meant you couldn't have it. Also, the laws were made to criminalize the melanated people, whether it was Mexican or American. Those laws were made just to imprison people. So marijuana became number one enemy in America, which it has been a staple crop in America for years and years and years.
Yeah, I didn't know that, and I, you know, it makes me sad that now there's a possibility of it becoming commercialized and abused, as many other crops have been.
Right on. With that, I would encourage folks to go to Dr. Yerger's faculty page. It is linked in the description to the program at the University of California at San Francisco. You can see a listing of all of her phenomenal work on the subject matter. of tobacco and a lot of the work that she's done with racism and how black people have been targeted. A lot of the reports you can link and you can read the information right there. Just outstanding information, and in my view, I would submit, should be shared with other black people. So that they can be more informed and presenting not just the smoke, the health aspect should be alone reason enough to be informed and to make sure that we are staying away and not using cigarettes and tobacco products, but certainly connecting that with this has been targeted chemical biological warfare with regards to racism, white supremacy against black people with these cigarettes, particularly menthol cigarettes. I think that that also would be hugely important and constructive in terms of getting us to think correctly about viewing this as poison. We want nothing to do with it. We're not going to use it, and making every effort to stop using it. And again, not blaming, as Dr. Yerger said, not blaming anyone or looking down on them if they smoke, just recognizing this is how they have been victimized, just helping them to get correct information to try to solve this problem and do everything that they can to quit. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your Wednesday evening with us, Dr. Yerger. I was supremely impressed with your scholarship and definitely hope we can have you back on the program to continue the dialogue.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I'm glad I got your email because we had a lot of traveling that we were doing the last couple of weeks, my colleagues and I, so I came back to an email box full of, I don't know, 400-something emails.
Wow.
And yours, I saw yours, and I was able to respond quickly, so thank you for the invitation.
For sure, for sure. University of California, San Francisco's Dr. Valerie Yerger. Thank you again. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening, and please continue your valuable, phenomenal research.
I shall do that. And thank you, everyone, for listening and participating. I really appreciate it. And this is why I do what I do, to have my interaction with my people and to share the information, to getting it out there.
We are grateful, and we'll share it to as many folks as possible. Take great care, and good evening, Dr. Yerger.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Good evening. Context of white supremacy. Fantastic information. If anything, I would say a lot of this just came from checking the newspaper, as I stated. I remember when we had Verdelia Randall on the program, author of Dying While Black, back way back 2009, the first time that she was on. And as I stated, she has a whole chapter in her book about a lot of the issues that we talked about this evening and tobacco smoking. And I remember that I thought that was so important. But just checking the New York Times, I encourage folks, make sure you're reading the newspaper. And they had the report just within the past 10 days, I believe, where they were talking about the renewed effort to combat the targeted targeting of black people with these menthol cigarettes, and trying to see if there's something that we can actually do to get that stopped so that they're not prevalent, so that they're not in areas, disproportionately in areas where you have a high concentration of black students, black children, so that they get their new generation of black people that are going to be poisoned with cigarettes. At any rate, I would definitely encourage folks to share. I think most of the times when I hear people talk about cigarette smoking, I do not hear it connected to racism. And I think that that would be really important in terms of just changing the way that we think about whether or not we want to consume tobacco products, so that children, really everybody, but in particular children, so that they understand that this is another F, just like Flint. We should think about, you know, Newport and all of that. We should think about that like Flint, Michigan, and the water crisis. This is just another effort to poison black people so that they understand it in that manner to influence them saying, hey, I want absolutely nothing to do with this. I know that this is racism, white supremacy. I know that you want me. And then I have to give you my money, too, for your program of genocide against black people, that I have to pay for this, too. Like, no way. We're not participating in that at all. I especially thought the research that she's done with regards to melanin and nicotine, astronomically important, as she stated, and particularly where she said that the difficulty that they run into trying to get funding is that they do not want her to explore and see what other information that there is in terms of this relationship. I am sure the tobacco industry and very powerful racist white supremacists, I'm sure they have done a lot of studying on that, and I'm sure that is a part of what is motivating them to make sure that you have widely available poison sticks, menthol cigarettes in areas where you have a lot of black children, and to make them cheaper in those areas. With all of our economic difficulties, struggling with, they talk about food deserts and everything else, we're not trying to make cheap, healthy, high quality food available for black people. We're trying to make cheap, readily available poison sticks for black people. That is racism, white supremacy, and deliberate chemical and biological warfare. But as I say, I think I'd said this some days before, I really wish that I had read some of Dr. Yerger's work before the passing of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. Really would have enjoyed hearing her thoughts about all of this. I suspect she might have known this. She was pretty informed and kept up with the news and what have you, so I suspect that this might not have been news to her, but I definitely would have enjoyed hearing her analysis, her thoughts on all of this. But I know she would want us to continue to check the news, be mindful, be informed about things that are happening. I can only say that for me, this is the sort of thing that I would encourage folks to think long and hard about when you hear the rhetoric about cannabis legalization. I certainly do not think that black people should be in greater confinement for consuming this product. But all of that that you will hear about, yes, this is grand and we need to have cannabis legal, recreationally available, that is nonsense. And you should look at what has happened with cigarettes and how that has been used. That right there, I would expect the exact same thing to happen with cannabis. I do not think that you're going to be able to come out with a long list of benefits for black people, and I would just make a check or a list of all of the things that they're saying that are going to be great, and this is how this will be a social justice movement. This will benefit black people, non-white people. If we do this, make a list and then see what happens. You can check the states where they've already legalized and states where it's going to happen. I would bet the farm California is going to legalize this time around. I would bet the farm. I think Nevada is on that list as well. That's another one. I would bet the farm that is probably going to pass. I don't know why it's not legal there anyway. They have prostitution. But to see, do these things actually happen? Do black people get any of the benefits in terms of black people being locked out of the economic aspect of this? That is well documented. We had the audio report on this program earlier this year. 1% of the people that are making profits, that are entrepreneurs in this cannabis rush, a la the gold rush, 1% of them are black people. And the evidence would suggest that they are deliberately structuring things in a manner to exclude black people from being the ones who are opening businesses and benefiting economically from all the money that's going to come from this. As I already stated, with the incarceration, they already have documents that are either unequivocal, too early to say whether or not this is actually going to do anything to keep black people from being arrested and going to jail, that sort of thing. And or in Colorado, it's the exact opposite, where you still have large numbers of black people, particularly younger black people, who are still being arrested for violating some sort of crime, possession of cannabis. If you're under 18, it's still illegal. So that's still going to be a crime. That's still happening in the state of Colorado, where they legalized in 2012 alongside the state of Washington. But this is just what I would encourage folks to think about. And certainly, I seriously doubt if they legalize. I haven't seen any evidence of that in Washington state, where once the product is legalized, that black people or anyone else are going to in droves begin growing their own cannabis. I haven't seen any evidence of that. And even if people were, they're still going to be consuming from other places, whether they're going to distributors to pick up and purchase whatever they're going to consume. Once you have racist white supremacists who are involved in that, whether they've done something to the seeds, whether they've done something with the soil or other additives that they put in the products, or if it's going to be edibles or whatever other form that they are producing these cannabis products, just keep in mind they have contaminated everything. Why on earth would you think they're not going to contaminate the legalized recreational cannabis? Nothing I have seen. This is the same position that I took in 2012 when it was legalized in Washington state. The same position that I've taken now. There's absolutely nothing that I have seen that would cause me to deviate from this at all. The underlying point, I see nothing about this that is going to work out well for black people. I could be in error. I don't think so. Folks have anything they need to comment what they heard from Dr. Yerger. Briefly, before we wrap things up, again, we'll be here tomorrow, Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Anything they need to get in, what they heard from Dr. Yerger, brief commentary?
Nabby Harris.
Female caller in New York, proceed.
Thank you, Thomas. Just to touch on something that Thomas said, I think he was the one that talked about sugar in the cigarettes. Dr. Layla Africa, Dr. Phil Valentine, and I believe Professor Griff also speaks about how sugar is like a drug within itself and is in everything. I mean, from the fast food and the cigarettes and the soda, anything that white people have a corporation for that they're making money that we can put in our mouths, sugar is the main ingredient, as well as MSG. And MSG has so many names that we can't even figure out what it is because it gives us a salty type of taste. So I'm quite sure that that's probably one of the deadly ingredients in cigarettes as well. Another point. With regard to, I think it was the female caller who asked about how marijuana is rolled in cigarette paper, probably called blunts. I saw an ad yesterday. I'm here in South Carolina, and I saw an ad yesterday in a store, and I started to take a picture of it, and I didn't, I didn't want to disturb the store owners, but it was for Dutch Masters, and it was a picture of 4 black youths, and they were like in this, like, you know, in these poses and everything, and it was for Dutch Masters, and then it had the picture of a cartoon picture of 4 white Dutchmen on the bottom of it. I don't know if anybody ever seen that ad, and that is targeted. I mean, that is like double targeting of with the marijuana and the tobacco at black youth. So I just wanted to make that comment, and that's all I had. I mute my line.
Thomas in New York.
They are called Dutch Masters, and there was plenty of Dutch Masters going around after New York is named after them. I just wanted to give a pushback to the gentleman caller. This is an argument you never make us. You, because I totally believe, you know, I agree with your argument that they should not be legalizing cannabis. But what about the local guys who sell the cannabis? They're going to be out of business. I mean, there's no way they're going to have CVS selling cannabis and still have little Pookie and Raheem around the corner selling it, too. It's not going to go down. And I would say that the people who try to sell it illegally, they're going to up the charges on them. It's not going to change too much. And that was the pushback I have to that. I thought this was a great show because, as you know, I do smoke cigarettes. And, man, it's a hard thing to try to stop. But I am definitely going to try to push towards stopping. Unfortunately, I just bought a pack today, and I'm not wasting my money. But I'm trying to do it. It's very hard. I've tried before. I've had the patches before, and it just made the cigarette taste better. You know, it was like, oh, man, this is really missed out, you know. But I really think that going cold turkey, I have my mother has a friend who claims that she was hypnotized. She went in there and threw her pack of cigarettes out on her way out and never smoked one again and didn't have any cravings or anything, and I just don't see how that's metabolically possible. I just wanted to say that. Thank you.
Appreciate that. I didn't, before today when you shared earlier, but yeah, before today I had forgotten that you smoke cigarettes, but thank you for sharing, and I'm sure there are a lot of folks in similar position. The addiction, the addictive components that they add to the cigarettes and everything to make it difficult to get rid of that habit, and have to pitch in myself, listeners as well, if you know you can find some resources that have seemed to be helpful for other black people to drop the smoking habit, share. I'm sure we have quite a few listeners who would appreciate that if there are some things that could be helpful letting that habit go, but that is what the system is designed to do. I think it's important, the more information that we have, to grasp how we ended up in this position and how whites have been targeting us. Chemical and biological warfare against us, I think that super helpful as well.
Nabby Earn?
I heard both of you, Roz and the other caller at 1902.
Go ahead, Roz. All right, I appreciate it. I wanted to just give Thomas a shout-out and just say I wish him the best in quitting. We've had conversations about this before, and I know it's really tough for him. Like I said, I first touched cigarettes at 11. I stopped when my mother threw them away. Then I picked them back up in my early 20s until about 25. And I never became addicted, per se, so I never understood, as far as from a personal standpoint, what addiction to cigarettes felt like. I just knew that when I was stressed, I would have them, and that was pretty much it. So it was very irregular. And, I know many people who were, including my mother before I was born, and it was it's something that I know is just a profoundly hard thing to break away from. And what I liked about this evening was that with everybody kind of chiming in with what they were dealing with or how they handled their addiction to nicotine or how they're working on it, I just thought it was great. And that's one of the big benefits, I think, of this platform. And I greatly appreciate the work you do, Gus. And as one of these suggestions, there's something that I've learned from a few people that I know that stopped smoking themselves. And it was around, I think it was one of the females that was speaking, who I think she was an addiction counselor or something. And she said that some of these behaviors with cigarettes and smoking cigarettes is centered around hand and mouth, having something in the mouth. And a few of the people I know utilize chew sticks, which is something that you'll find like Muslim people sell or Caribbean people will sell them. And they have different flavors, and you can actually chew them. And it's basically a piece of flavored wood. They use them in the Caribbean and on the continent as toothbrushes, but also, you know, you can use them to freshen your breath and keep your mouth clean and tighten your gums around your teeth. So it's something that a few people I know have utilized to help around that, needing to have something in your mouth to occupy the space that would have been occupied by a cigarette. So it's something I just wanted to throw out there as well. Thank you very much, and I'll mute my line.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
This is, again, to all the callers, and to you, Thomas. I mean, just quit. Just quit. I know it's easier said than done, but if you're going to waste your money, you say you're not going to waste your money, but those, like you said, them death sticks. I'm going to tell you how I didn't want to go into detail how I quit, because I wanted the other callers to get questions in. I quit because it was a situation where I had, I have a car that I don't drive in the wintertime. I'm in the Midwest. And my cousin's girlfriend, who was white, ding, 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 I put it in storage in the winter. When it came around November, snow about to hit, you know, she said I could use the garage as storage. Then she reneged on it and said, no, I got to do something else. It totally pissed me off. And she knew I was pissed, and she offered me a cigarette. Are you kidding me? She offered me a cigarette. And I wanted to call her every fluffy, white, fat name in the book. But I reserved that. I didn't go tacky with her, but that I used that. I said, you know what? I'm done. Like, you know, the fact that I'm pissed that she would offer me a cigarette really pissed me off. So if you do got that pack of cigarettes, throw it. Because at the end of the day, you waste your money either way. And so now you ain't killing yourself, you waste your money. How many other dumb things you might buy for $7, $10, $12, you know? It's just like, man, the best way is to quit and use, like, each urge as a round of boxing. And you, if you're not knocked out, you don't smoke. So you might have to go through 100 rounds. But I'm telling you, once you do, the reason I had to get on tonight is because I love to pat myself on the back knowing that. And I use one more thing. How long I've been on this earth smoking compared to me being on this earth not smoking. And if it goes the other way where you're smoking, you've been on this earth longer smoking than being alive, breathing in air, regular air, then let's try to balance that out. Let's try to get it to where before you die, you've been on this earth longer not smoking than smoking. And that's how I did it. I'll
be
my
line. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I'll try to make this brief. With quitting smoking, I would definitely suggest that any of the listeners listen to the archives as far as this show tonight, because everything she said was what I learned in training. Listen to it with a pen and paper. There's going to be an oral fixation. There's going to be a hand, like the motions and the movements. You're going to have things where you want to do those things. So I would even suggest, on top of getting a chew stick, toothpick, cinnamon stick, gum, mint, something for the hands. Even if you just like to click a pen, because you're going to want to strike something to get as motioning as if you were going to light a flame. These movements with your body are so repetitive that it just becomes a part of you. I would take note on times that I strongly want a cigarette, like if it's after eating a meal, if it's specifically, you know, after intimacy and those things, and come up with something else to do, so that, you know, like she was saying with the trigger, so that you're not triggered to do those, to have a cigarette. The 5 D's are like standard with most cessation groups or counselors refer people who want to quit smoking to, which is delay, to distract yourself, drink a lot of water, deep breathing. But I'd want to add into that physical activity. For some reason, taking a walk helps a lot with quitting. So if after meals it was an issue, you'd take a walk after meals. I know that's hard for people who live in New York, where the weather's always changing and you can have, you know, winter's coming up soon, there's going to be snow, but finding another activity to do really helps. And as far as, because I know that the cigarettes have a flavor, if you like flavored water, if you like teas, something that's not, I wouldn't suggest candy, because when you smoke, your mouth gets really dry, and then you're trying to quit, and you may gradually bring yourself down. When you just add candy and sugar, it just opens you up to get cavities because of the drying effect of the cigarette. So I would stray away from candies. That was it.
Great suggestions. Definitely appreciate that. The shoe sticks, licorice sticks, I think that's what they are. I am a fan of licorice sticks, and I am not a smoker, and did not get on them trying to stop smoking or anything like that. They're great for a lot of different reasons. And they, people, as Roz stated, black people, different parts of the world use them as natural toothbrushes. If you look at a lot of the natural toothpastes, they have licorice in them, but you can find them online. If you're in an area where you don't see people selling them, you can get them online, just licorice sticks, and you'll be able to get yourself a big, huge sack of them if you so desire, because that can, a lot of times when I have it in my mouth, people have asked me, you know, do you have that because you're trying to stop smoking? That, I think a lot of people have used them because it can get, I guess, give a similar feel to having a cigarette in your mouth or having it in your hand to help with some of the behavior patterns that you're going to be dealing with if you're trying to stop smoking. I did want to make sure I included a view of, and just to again emphasize, you should probably check out Dr. Yerger's different reports that she's co-authored. It's just amazing information that she's been compiling for a number of years. This is from her 2012 report, Quid Pro Quo, Tobacco Companies in the Black Press, which was published in 2012. Well, she says there's suggestive evidence that op-eds supporting the tobacco companies were ghostwritten, unsigned by the tobacco industry or its consultants, and then bylined by influential black leaders. For example, it's one of the tobacco industry's public affair firms. Ogilvy and Mather was involved with coordinating an op-ed signed by Congressman Mervyn M. Damali, arguing against federal tobacco excise tax, which was published in 20 black publications. I thought that was really important because we talked about this before. Clarence Pendleton was another black male where racists would publish all of these articles that were supporting their white supremacist view, and then they would put Clarence Pendleton's name on. He's a black male, and so people would fuss at him, but actually he's not the person that wrote the reports. This is something that they've been doing for a long time. So that way we can fuss and blame and yell at a black person for a stance that has been written, conceived by a racist man, racist woman, racist child. While we should really, in my view, really disengage with fussing at, yelling at other black people, it just doesn't solve any problems. The next piece, she is from the same report. As a black press historian said, the black press was never intended to be objective. It often took a position. This was a press of advocacy. If African-American readers across the decades of the last century assumed that the black press advocated positions on their behalf, then the quid pro quo we have described takes on new significance. National Newspaper Publishers Association. This is like a consortium of black writers. They get pieces published in lots of different publications throughout the country. Newspaper readers likely expected that publishers had their best interest at heart and assumed that they conveyed complete, accurate information about tobacco's harmfulness and about public policy measure to reduce it. These publications apparent prioritization of serving the tobacco industry over safeguarding their readers' health suggests that they may not have fully appreciated the extensive harm that tobacco caused the black community. I thought that was really important as well. Just lots of examples of this, but black people being compromised by racist white supremacists. And she also makes what I think is a very important point, that this was not in fact, I can just read it. She says the term quid pro quo applied to the Tobacco National Newspaper Publisher Association relationship should have a simple meaning: money paid to the NNPA in exchange for valuable advertising. However, the tobacco industry expected more than this equal exchange. Tobacco companies viewed their support of the black press as buying its loyalty and securing its favor. This relationship represents a quid pro quo plus, that is expecting a return of more than equal value. And I would just highlight under all of this, regardless of how much money they gave to whatever black press outlets, the racist tobacco industry, they are benefiting not just from you're selling our products, you are promoting our ideas, and we are devastating the health of black people, probably in more ways than we are even aware. That is way beyond whatever few nickels are given out to any black journalist. I think that is hugely important. And she goes into more detail in some of her work explaining that. But just phenomenal scholarship. You should really check out her work. And again, the same thing I said at the beginning of the program, keeping in mind their research on melanin and nicotine, having melanin being like a super receptor. I think that's the way Dr. Niana Rasayan has described it before, as have many others. But sucking up the toxins from that nicotine, and it might just be that that just gets stored in melanin-heavy tissue in your body, being stored for who knows how long, so that we're just being poisoned over a long period of time. As she said, that's her theory. Needs more research that whites don't want to fund. That is no surprise to me as well. But again, I would encourage folks to think of it. Chemical and biological warfare, that's the way that we should talk about cigarettes and our opposition to death sticks cigarette smoking. We will stop there. We'll be here tomorrow. Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. It'll be good to hear from folks. I don't know if what's happening, the unrest in North Carolina around the shooting of another black male, if that is popping up on the job, but we'll certainly have time to discuss tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If folks have additional questions, comments, if you need help finding something in the archives, feel free, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks to all of the callers. glad to hear your thoughts, perspectives, and share with as many folks as possible. Particularly if you have black people that you care about who smoke cigarettes, you should definitely share this broadcast. I will state again, particularly with what we've heard this evening, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. And I will share something that I think Mr. Fuller has talked about before, about we should really be making sure that we are not increasing our needs. This should apply to not just, in my view, tobacco products, cannabis, alcohol, any other substances that whites decide that they want to legalize and would be great, methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin, anything else. We really do not want to increase our needs. Even if they were giving away cannabis for free, which they may at some point, or cigarettes, beer, whatever else. This is going to be something where once I get it, it becomes addictive and I'm going to want more of this. I'm going to have some sort of biochemical need, craving for this substance. That is, we do not need any more of that at all. Like, we should just view that as the plague. Get that away from me. Black people, as victims of white supremacy, we already have enough needs that are not being met. We do not need any further unnecessary needs, cravings. That should be like the lowest priority of all for black people. At any rate, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Certainly if you're going to be behind the wheel of a vehicle. I think Sandra Bland even had some problems smoking a cigarette with a race soldier, but if you're going to be behind the wheel, you do not want to be under the influence of anything. You do not want that to be the day that you bump into Daniel Holdsclaw, Darren Wilson. That is certainly not going to make your day go easier. It is not going to help you solve any problems under the system of white supremacy. We want to be lucid, clear thinking at all times so that we can make phenomenal decisions to keep ourselves as safe as possible. That's it. It has been time. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest level of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.